Hi, and welcome to The Debrief Show. I'm your host, Dee Clayton. I'm an executive coach, a trainer, and I'm passionate about all things communication. The Debrief Show is a show for leaders to help you to bring out the best in yourself, in others, and in your communications. In this episode, I'm going to be talking to Hayley Brackley, and she's a neurodiversity consultant. She's a TEDx speaker, and she's a coach, and she's passionate about all things inclusive in the workplace. She has lived experience of ADHD, dyslexia, and autism, and she combines all of that expertise along with her expertise in learning and development and leadership, organization, and culture in order to bring this consultancy and advice together. She's an expert at engaging, thought-provoking sessions, and they're filled with honesty, humor, and practical insights you can apply straight away. I really enjoyed this chat with her, and I'm super excited to be sharing it with you now. So welcome, Hayley. Tell us a little bit about your background, if you may.
Thanks very much, Dee. A little bit about my background. Where do I start? Do I start with my first day at school where I got sent home at lunchtime for biting one of the other children?
No.
Do I skip on 10 years to the point where I got an ADHD diagnosis and was the first girl that my psychiatrist had diagnosed?
Oh, no.
Shortly after that, I was assessed as dyslexic. I absolutely did not thrive at school and somehow managed to leave with amazing grades.
Wow.
Go figure. And then I think if I kind of skip forwards a few years, I have two elements to the background that I suppose is most relevant here. One is an L&D background, and then the other one is a neurodivergent person in the workplace trying to figure out how this thing works. And for me, I now brought the two together.
And how did you get into the L&D background then? If you just with your good grades, or you, how did that come about?
No. So I went into the world of work immediately after school, and found myself, I did a couple of utterly boring jobs, processing housing benefit. Like, that's a 0 out of 10 stars recommendation on that role. And then I moved into the fire service, where I had a couple of different roles. And the final role that I had there was in L&D. I have a really strong interest in humans and how they work and occupational psychology. And, you know, how do we create workplaces where people get to come to work and be happy and healthy and productive? Because, you know, they're really good things for people to be. And so, yeah, I just kind of naturally found myself landed, I suppose, into that role, and then went, wow, what a job. Like, imagine a job where you get paid to talk to people and help people and, you know, allow people to find their work easier because they've got different ways around it. And
fantastic. So playing to all your skills then, playing to your interests. So what does neurodiversity at work mean to you?
It's a good question. And I think if we break it down, there's a couple of elements, starting off with what does neurodiversity mean? Mm-hmm. And this really is that kind of absolute natural variation between all of us, all of our brains, thinking, working, focusing, communicating, interacting with the world differently. On the flip side, we have the word neurodivergence. So those of us like myself, whose brains think, work differently from the majority. And so I think both of those words are really key when we talk about neurodiversity at work, because it's not just about your colleague who has ADHD, your autistic colleague. Actually, it's about everybody and all of those brains getting to thrive. You know, the systems that are set up for humans to excel, and the fact that there really isn't an average brain in the workplace.
And that's how you sort of come back to things, isn't it? We'll come back to that in a minute. But before we get on to that, some leaders find it quite awkward to talk about this because they don't know the right terms. Is it neurodivergence? Is it neurodiversity? Is it autistic? Is it ADHD? And they get so tongue-tied, they don't really know what to say and probably don't say anything. How do you advise leaders to talk about it or think about it?
I think the first thing is to really lean into kind of what you've said there. Why is this awkward? Why does it feel uncomfortable? And generally, it's because we're nice people that don't want to offend somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
We want to make sure that we're getting it right. And there's a great deal of importance with language in any inclusion space. You know, we've seen that in other sectors of inclusion. When we confuse or conflate words, what impact that has on the identity that we're giving to somebody. So we know that words are really important. That's the first element to this. Mm-hmm. We also know that knowledge isn't a given in this area. You may get some people who, through personal interest, they understand a little bit about it. But overall, in a workplace, it's not something that we've spoken about for long. You know, it really is a relatively new conversation. We also see, how do we have a conversation that says there's something about you that's kind of not working in this setting, which is often where these conversations start from.
Hmm.
And there's a lot of crossover between mental health, personality, you know, and then into neurodivergence. And so having all of these different factors means that it is a big topic. It is a huge topic. It is something where it's really understandable that there is that fear of getting it wrong. And I think that's key to us then figuring out, how do we move forwards with it?
And I think that you're right. Nobody wants to upset anybody on purpose. And then with legal standing as well, nobody wants to say anything that's legally wrong, or wrong with HR as well, isn't it? So I guess that puts extra complicated layers on top as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Neurodivergence is often, but not always, considered a disability under the Equality Act, and the Act affords extra protection for those who are disabled. And so, absolutely, there's the whole, you know, I don't want to say something that could be deemed as discriminatory. I don't want to say something that could be seen as the wrong word. And ultimately, we haven't for long enough focused on that, how do I help you have a great day at work? We've really looked at kind of what boxes do we need to put people in, and how do we talk about that in a really kind of clinical manner? And that doesn't help us to have really human conversations.
So tell me, a little bit about did you get a diagnosis, and how did that come about? And then what do you think the average journey is like for somebody in corporate? Is it similar to yours, like nobody knows for a while and then they find out when they're younger or older? What about your journey, and then maybe the journey of other people that you have talked to?
Absolutely. So my journey, my first diagnosis was ADD rather than ADHD, so without the hyperactivity element. And that was when I was 14. And it was really following a very turbulent teenage time. As I mentioned earlier, I was the first girl that was diagnosed by my psychiatrist, and nobody really understood ADD or ADHD back then at all. I got a dyslexia assessment following that. And then it was much, much later in life. It was only a few years ago that I found out that I'm autistic. Mm. Back in the day, I definitely wasn't autistic for a number of reasons. One, you couldn't be autistic and have ADHD.
Ah, they decided that, did they?
They did, absolutely. They were seen as polar opposites. And so you couldn't have both until actually only kind of just over 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. That was the first thing. Second thing, I was a girl. I didn't have a strong affinity to Lego, space or trains.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't flap my arms up and down. And really, that was kind of, and I was reasonably astute with emotional intelligence. And these were our kind of very identifying markers for autism back in the day. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't fit that profile. And actually, it came as a bit of a surprise when I realized that, you know, I'm not just useless at making friends, and I'm not utterly socially awkward. I'm not really pedantic about clothing choices, or I'm not a control freak because I organize events because then I know what will happen at the event. Actually, all of that is just part of being autistic. Mm. So for me, it was a multi-part diagnosis. I think in terms of what's average, it is so nuanced and varied that there isn't really an average pathway. We're seeing younger generations talking about this much more. There's much more openness, there's much more awareness in school, which means the younger end of our workforce are often coming into work with a really strong understanding of themselves, suspected neurodivergence, even if not diagnosed. A couple of years ago, we saw an absolute surge in referrals for women in their 30s and 40s. This was previously a massively underdiagnosed, underassessed demographic. We didn't look for it in girls. And so there is a large number of women, particularly those who are assigned female at birth, who found themselves diagnosed at that point in life. However, there's also a large number of men and those assigned male at birth getting that diagnosis, because just because they didn't have the kind of hyperactive bouncing off the walls ADHD back when they were a child doesn't mean that they don't have ADHD. And this is just taking one kind of diagnosis, one condition as the example there.
A lot of my clients have noticed these kind of things once they've had their own children and then diagnosed, and then I don't know if the doctors or therapists or whatever say, should you look at your, I don't know if they say that or they just work it out themselves.
I think the majority of the time it doesn't come from the clinician. Most of the time it comes from looking at a form and going, well, isn't it just normal to do that? And then you sense check yourself and you think, well, that is absolutely my normal, you know, that is. And then you think, oh, okay, that all of the things that are being described about my child as traits of whichever condition we're talking about, they're quite relevant to me as well. And yeah, that then is often the thing that really kind of is a catalyst for somebody getting that understanding.
Yeah. And it's difficult, I guess, once you've got that. In a way it's good because you know what it is, but then in another way some people don't know then what to do, especially with adults. You haven't got that obvious path of where to go. What do you do with that, have you? I think we were talking about that when we chatted the other week, weren't we?
Yeah, and it depends on which condition as well. So ADHD and autism are covered by the NHS depending on which county you live in, and so there is a pathway in place for those. Something like dyslexia, dyspraxia, dysgraphia, dyscalculia, there isn't really a pathway, particularly not for adults. You're looking at a private assessment, and in order to go for that private assessment, you have to be pretty sure that you know what it is you want to be assessed for. You know, if you're having difficulty concentrating, is that coming from an attention deficit relating to ADHD? Is that coming from a difficulty in processing written word, coming from dyslexia? Is it coming from being overwhelmed by the sensory environment around you, coming from autism? You've got to be able to pinpoint, otherwise you're going to put yourself through multiple expensive assessments.
Yeah. And is it useful to have an assessment as an adult?
This is one of those things that there isn't going to be a clear-cut answer. In my experience, I would say the vast majority of people I've spoken to have benefited from having had that assessment. It's very few that have found that it's not a benefit. Some people might find a little bit of neutrality towards it, like, well, okay, I know, and I'm still me, and that's it. For me personally, if I talk about sort of understanding that I'm autistic, it was an absolute game changer, you know. And I'm somebody who understands neurodivergence. I talk about it. I understood ADHD. I knew a lot about how my brain worked. But what I struggled to recognize is that actually for me, socializing does feel different to what is stereotypically expected. And that my energy levels do fluctuate in different ways. And that actually extreme overwhelm will cause a shutdown. And that's not about pushing through and being more resilient and just, you know, getting on with it. That's about really stepping back and saying, okay, there needs to be some profound regulation happening here. What does that look like?
So managing yourself, so it can help not to give yourself like excuses, but to find strategies that work for you. Talking about moving forward then and being helpful, what are some things that leaders say that are helpful things that leaders say or do that you've seen with your clients or with other people that you think, okay, this is a good way to deal with this situation or to not deal with it is probably even the wrong word in itself, isn't it? Whatever the word I should be using, manage situations with neurodivergence and neurodiversity in your team.
I think with anything like this, we have to come back to the foundation fundamentals, which is what is the culture of the team. If we have a team that has a highly competitive culture, if we have one that has a toxic culture, one where people are kind of getting one over on each other, feeling scared, feeling like they have to overly justify themselves, that's not going to be conducive to somebody telling you what's easy or what's difficult for them. Mm. So that's got to be the very first port of call, is looking at overall, what is the culture of this team, of this environment? Is it one that really does say you're welcome as you, or is it one that says we need to grind off the edges of you to make you fit here?
Mm. Or if they say you're welcome as you, but they don't mean it.
And that's exactly it. And, you know, one of the traits of neurodivergence is pattern matching. And when you pattern match, you can often see through that kind of lack of sincerity and integrity, mm-hmm. which can create huge challenges in itself. So we've got to, it comes back to really positive workplace culture. Moving on from there, you know, be specific. Things like shout if you need anything. What does that mean? Whereas saying, here are some things that we can do. You know, this is what's worked for somebody else. Are any of those useful, or is there something else? That gives us a good kind of like, okay, I've got a bit of a starting point now. I don't feel like I'm just shooting out into the dark. Not diminishing things. You know, we all have a little bit of ADHD. We're all a bit autistic. We're all on a spectrum somewhere. All of these statements, whilst sometimes meant really well, you know, like we're trying to relate to that person. We're trying to say, yeah, I understand what it can feel like. Hmm. Actually, what we're then saying is your challenges aren't as significant as you think they are. Everybody else experiences this, you know. Actually, something like, occasionally I find that difficult, and then thinking about what can help you, you know, what is it that you might need in this moment? Mm. And then the final point that I'll make is around, we don't need a diagnosis. Often we can think, oh gosh, right, okay, let me get you referred into occupational health. Let me figure out how we get you a diagnosis. The law tells us, the Equality Act states, that we do not need a diagnosis.
Oh, okay.
But also, just from a, you know, imagine somebody says, I'm really struggling reading these long emails. And rather than looking at how do we help you with those really long emails, we say, okay, great. Let's go into a 6 to 12 month process of getting you a dyslexia assessment. Mm. I mean, that assessment can come back and say they're not dyslexic. That's still not helping them with the emails, has it?
No. Yeah. So helping them in a practical way, asking them, what can we do to support you in that? Nice. Okay, so let's say you suspect somebody in your team is neurodivergent, but they haven't said anything, or maybe they don't know either. What might I notice? What kind of clues am I looking out for? And then what adjustments should I make? Anything different from what you've kind of said already?
Fab. So in terms of clues, I mean, there's going to be different things in different people. So the first thing I want to caveat is don't get too hung up on looking for specific things. Mm-hmm. Typically, what we're looking at is where we've got mismatches in performance, behavior, you know, something that is sitting outside of what we would overall expect. That can be something that kind of is enlightening in itself. And that then leads into the where do we go from here? I don't recommend conversations from managers to say, could you have ADHD? When we look, I'm going to use just one example here. When we look at, say, autism, and we look at the traits around autism that we might notice in the workplace, and then we look at deep-seated trauma, there can be an awful lot of overlap.
Mm.
It's not a manager's place to try and figure out whether this is trauma, autism, OCD, ADHD, or anything else aside from those. Mm. It's a manager's place to make the workplace and the employee as productive as it can be. And so looking at what is it that we're talking about, what is it that we're noticing, is going to give us a greater outcome than trying to figure out what box should you be put in. You know, so if you're noticing that that person appears to find it really difficult to stand up in a meeting and talk to people, that's the thing that you want to be focusing on. If you're noticing that this person's producing written work and actually it's not to the standard that you would be expecting, that's what we want to be looking at. Typically, we often notice when something isn't where we'd like it to be rather than the other way around. And that is just the nature of it. You know, we tend to accept if something's good, we accept it's good for whatever reason it's good.
Yeah.
If something's not so great, that's when we start to think, why might it not be so great?
On that side of things, then, is it likely that somebody who's neurodivergent is more likely to be really good at something else? Or is that true or not really true? Like, I'm just wondering if you can be really clear on what they're really good at, sort of to balance out the bit where you're saying, okay, let's improve your emails or whatever the thing is we're going to work on, or is that not necessarily true that they're going to have this strength? But they probably will have a strength, but it might not be in your workplace, I guess.
And that's exactly it. You know, humans, by the nature of being humans, have strengths and challenges, whether they are neurodivergent or neurotypical. Neurotypical is a word that we use to describe those whose brains operate in the majority expected way within a society. So, you know, because somebody is autistic and finds the noisy kind of meeting halls difficult does not mean that when you set up a computer and ask for somebody to do some coding, they're going to step in and be excellent at it.
About to ask you to do some coding for me.
Yeah, you definitely don't want me to do any kind of coding for you ever. But so what we mustn't do is try and pigeonhole those strengths and say, you know, you have this strength because you are. I often see those with ADHD have amazing hyperfocus abilities. And you know what? That's brilliant. But the last time I hyperfocused on something, it was about I needed to design some training and all I was looking at was which Apple Watch I should get. And I can now tell you the spec of the last 5 models of Apple Watches because that's what I hyperfocused on. Now, I wouldn't say that's a workplace strength, if I'm honest with you.
No.
You know, and it's about balance, isn't it? We've moved away from saying, do you know what? You should employ women in your workplace because women are empathetic and caring and make great tea. And we can now recognize that, do you know what? You should employ people in your workplace, regardless of gender, because people can be really good at the things you need them to do.
Mm.
And it's the same kind of thing with strengths of neurodivergence. Actually, don't try and recruit autistic people for a particular role or dyslexic. Recruit people for the roles and make sure that we've got the systems around them that allow people to thrive and that we don't have those barriers that trip people up.
Mm-hmm. Is there any tips and techniques that you have seen that work really well, or we kind of discussed most of those, but is there anything that obvious that's peeing to mind? It's fine if there isn't.
Do you mean in terms of things that can help in a workplace?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think the first ones, it sounds really obvious, but oh my word, you know, people don't do it, is expect difference.
Mm-hmm.
Human nature is that we, for some reason, believe that other people are going to think the same way as us. Mm. And so we think that if we are describing an elephant,
mm-hmm.
somebody else is going to know exactly what that elephant looks like. But do you know what? You know, my color of gray is different to yours. My idea of a cartoon is different to yours. So even if you've been that explicit, doesn't mean that we're going to come up with the same thing. Mm. Once you've got that in your brain, you will take the blame away from that other person for not getting your elephant because you'll recognize that this is difference, you know, not better or worse. Think about how do we make things as simple as they can be without being oversimplified. What that might look like is rather than having really long policy documents where you've got to read through the entire thing, there's a robust executive summary at the top of them so that people can see, you know, what actually is within this. The same with emails. Nobody loves a 4-page email. So put at the top of it what you need and when you need it by. If you feel that the context is still needed below, great. but actually at least then it's easy for somebody to filter through. Meetings, there's a few things we can do to make meetings work better. Have an agenda so that people know what's going to happen. Have an etiquette so that we're inviting contribution but not mandating it.
Mm-hmm.
Allow people to have their cameras off. You know, people don't just have their cameras off because actually they're watching Jeremy Kyle or doing the washing up or haven't got dressed yet. There are many, many people who have the camera off because they find it exhausting to be sat, you know, in the right way, looking forwards. Mm. I know that when I deliver training and I love to see people's faces. Mm. I love it. And I will thank people, but also absolutely acknowledge. When I am the delegate, I really struggle. And that's because I listen best when I'm doodling, when I'm fiddling, when I'm fidgeting. I might sit on the floor for a little bit and have a listen. I might, get out my massive tub of post-it notes and color code them. And from the outside eye, that looks like I'm not listening. And so what that means is that I end up covering up the behaviors that allow me to listen at my best because my camera's on and because I want to look like I'm listening. If I'm allowed my camera off, even if it's periodically, you know, on and off, I'll turn it on for a bit, What that means is that I get the autonomy to work in that way that works for me.
Mm, I like that because I'm definitely one of those, you know, I've taught a lot of presentation skills and virtual presentation skills training. And I'm one of those people that, please, if you can, put your cameras on. So I definitely would prefer that because then I can see how it's landing. Yeah, so that's a really interesting way of understanding why some people haven't got their cameras on. But I like that compromise of so what would be useful is to have your cameras on in this exercise or something like that, Emma. And I think that's a nice sort of midway compromise, isn't it, for your colleagues to see that you're engaging in the way they think you're engaging, not watching Jeremy Kyle, but for you to have that space to listen properly. I think that's fascinating and that's really interesting. And the rest of them sound like really sensible things that I'm training people in anyway, etiquette in meetings, having agendas, doing executive summaries at the beginning of emails. And it sounds like AI is going to help us a lot with that, make things a lot more simple as well.
Yeah.
One of the things I did when I was writing to you actually was saying, because I was trying to practice what we're preaching and saying, are my questions useful in, you know, and some of them aren't because they're two questions in one, which is what we tend to do, but you're managing great with that. But it's not a good practice really to ask two questions in one anyway. So all of these things that we should be doing sound like they're really useful for everyone, don't they?
Yeah. And this comes back to the concept of neurodiversity. You know, we all have different fingerprints. We all have different irises. We all have different brains. There are going to be some people who find managing their time absolutely easy, you know, like no problem at all. And some people are going to really struggle with managing their time and need some support. Some people can walk into a meeting and ad lib the whole way through it, and other people need the structure. And when we look at those who sit potentially furthest outside of our expectations, and we look at how do we make it okay for you, how do we make it so that you can come in this meeting feel like an acceptable place, even an opportunity for you to contribute in your way. Well, actually, when we design for the edges, we include the middle by default.
Mm.
Whereas previously, we've just designed for the middle for so long that we've not thought about the edges.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to look at it. So this is fascinating. I could go on forever, but I think we're coming towards the end of our chat. But a couple of things. Firstly, I want to ask you about time management because you just mentioned it and I've written all of your tips down here. But in this world of overwhelm, not just, you know, well, for everybody, really, isn't it? But specifically something around managing time. Have you got some top tips or apps that you use or that you'd recommend or techniques? What do you recommend for people struggling with that outside of the kind of normal by a time management calendar and block your time out? I talk about, you know, blocking your diary out and managing time, not tasks. What do you teach people to do or share with them?
One of the biggest things for me is that actually there's no one size fits all. And we know that, but we forget. And so then when we've tried blocking our time out, we've color-coded our calendar, we've bought a planner for the 87th time, and it's, you know, still not, we blame ourselves and we go, I just can't do this. But actually, it might just be that you've not yet found the thing.
Yeah.
The other thing that makes a massive difference is we have this real notion that something should work and it should work indefinitely. And we apply this to things like, you know, fitness. We should get into running and we should just be a runner then. Like that should be our thing. Well, actually, if your end goal is to be fit, you could do running for 3 weeks. You could do cycling for a couple of weeks. You could try out a bit of kickboxing. You could come back to running for a week. You could do that. Inconsistency keeps novelty. The novelty keeps engagement. And that allows you to get your end result of getting fitter. It's the same thing with time management. So if you find that color coding your diary worked for 3 weeks and now isn't really working for you, you're not broken and it's not broken. Thank it. A little bit like that Marie Kondo, you know, thank it for the time that it brought you.
Yeah.
And move on.
Yeah.
You know, and try another technique for a little bit. There is not any perfect tool for time management. And I will go against anybody that wants me to try their thing. And, you know, I have tried everything that I could possibly find. And there is not a perfect one. There is a lot of marketing that will help us to believe that this next thing is good. And what that does is it reinforces that we're the problem.
You're not using the right system.
Exactly. But you know what? If we flip that around and go, time management is tricky for some people, really, really tricky. And there are bits that can help, but it's still going to be hard work. What a difference that makes. No longer is it, you know, you're just not using the right system. Keep trying to find something else that you go, okay, this one makes it 20% easier. Color coding my diary, that's not perfect, but it does make it 20% easier.
Nice. I like that. I love that idea. Trying to build up what makes it easier. I like that. And I really like that idea of trying different things. And this is where, you know, maybe the diagnosis is useful, because when I'm talking to my clients, if we can Google or search or AI, whatever we're going to do these days, but we're going to be able to instruct AI or whatever to say, can you give me some time management? Because I've been trying color coding and now I'm bored of it or whatever, or it's not working for me anymore. Then if you put the right thing in, it's going to give you more chances to choose out of these 10 ideas, because sometimes it can be hard to come up with your own ideas. If you don't know what the ideas are, then you go to somebody who doesn't think in the same way as you. They're only going to suggest their ways. So you need to find ways for you. But how do you do that? So searching and putting in the right things, I guess, is important to that, isn't it?
Definitely. And I think this is where, you know, you don't need an ADHD diagnosis to resonate with ADHD traits, for example. And so if it is that you resonate with the ADHD trait of finding time management difficult, doing a Google search for time management techniques for those with ADHD, skip down all your sponsored posts where it's all about marketing to this thing is going to be perfect for you, and find an article that says 10 ways that you can try. Have a search through that. You might find body doubling, where you do something alongside somebody else doing their thing. That gives you a social anchor, gives you a bit of accountability. You might find breaking tasks down. You might find, at the minute, I'm all about an A5 plain piece of paper to-do list. That's my thing. A couple of weeks ago, it was a spreadsheet and I could make it do a little tick when it was done. There's going to be different things at different points for different people, but you're absolutely right. You know, that we are blessed and cursed with AI, Google, technology. Actually, one of the real merits of it is that we can find alternatives, where before people would tell us to, have you considered writing a list? And, you know, do the Pomodoro technique and eat the frog. That was the three things. You know, you go to any time management workshop.
Yeah, in the olden days, buy a Filofax, if anyone's old enough to remember. I don't know if you're old enough to remember
that. I am old enough, but thank you for the compliment that I might not have been.
I used to have a Filofax, and then I'd have stickers all over it because it all changed, or Tippexing it out in the olden days.
Yeah.
I love a good iPad nowadays. Wow, you've just, I love the way you talk about it in such a user-friendly way, such a easy to understand manner, and you don't make anybody feel awkward about anything. So I would highly recommend any of our listeners to get in touch with you if they want to do some work with you. You're a speaker, aren't you? You've done a TEDx talk, so you can do conference speeches. You'll come in and advise people as well. Or tell us, what else have I missed? Is there anything else that you would like to let people know about? Is there a resource that you want people to see? Or is there an invitation to have a chat with you? What would you like to say to so that people can learn more about this topic?
So, to answer your multi-part question.
Oh, good, million-part question.
Million-part. Yeah, absolutely. First one, services I offer, absolutely, as you say, keynote speaker, workplace training, so neurodiversity-themed workplace training, and coaching as well, so neurodiversity and exec coaching. That's the services part answered.
Right. And do you have some resources for us to have a look?
So resources. The best thing that I would recommend people do is go to my website, www.greatmindsdon't.co.uk. And on there is a newsletter sign up. If you sign up to the newsletter, once a month, I send out a I Love Lighthouses. So I call it the ND Lighthouse newsletter. Within that, I always make sure that it is packed with stuff that's useful. So
you could, I mean, truly packed. I got your newsletter. It had the body doubling stuff in there, didn't it?
It did.
And it had about a million other things as well.
Yeah. I decided that what I didn't want to do is a weekly newsletter with dribs and drabs. So I was like, let's make it like a little mini magazine. You know, get yourself a biscuit and a cup of tea and have a sit down and have a read. And it gives you a different resource every month.
Yeah. Really does. Thank you. That's brilliant. Wonderful. Before I wrap up, is there anything that you think we should know that I haven't covered? Is there any question that I haven't asked you?
Oh, there's probably so many. And now I'm thinking of all of the various things that you could. But I think perhaps the final thing to say is that, yes, this is a huge topic. Mm. Yes, it can be complex, but that doesn't mean that it's too complicated to approach.
Just start somewhere, right?
Absolutely.
Brilliant. So thank you so much for putting up with my multiple questions in a row without giving you a chance to answer. You've been brilliant guest. Thank you so much. And I'll drop some of the contact stuff in the show notes for people.
Amazing. Thank
you. Lovely to chat to you. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thanks again to our special guest, Hayley Brackley. And her website again is Great Minds Don't. We put that in the show notes. If you've enjoyed today's show, please share it with other people that you think will really benefit from this information. Please share it. Let people know what we're doing here. And if you are new, welcome. Thank you for joining us and welcome to our community. We do regular debrief shows. We're aiming for every couple of weeks to bring you new and interesting guests and have the kind of conversations that really add value to your workplace. So please feel free to share this, and you can find this episode and other episodes on YouTube if you like watching the videos. Just search D Clayton, and on my playlist, there is a debrief show playlist, or come and join us over on the podcast channel, whatever's your favorite, but we're definitely on Apple, we're on Spotify and all of those other channels. So find us there. Please follow, subscribe, click whichever button it is that you want to, ring the bell, all of those things, so that you can keep up to date when we do new episodes. Thank you for being part of our community. And until next time, take care.